Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Podcart's Life is Like a Box of Records podcast. My name is Helena Rafai. Occasionally, we bring in special guests to talk about the songs that have soundtracked their lives so far. For rights reasons, music may be shorter than the original song. Podcart's Life is Like a Box of Records is recorded, produced and edited by me, Helena Rafai. Original music is by Susan Baer, aka Good Dog. This week's guest is Hannah Curry. Hannah is a music promoter, DJ, documentary filmmaker and mental health advocate. She's been an integral part of the Scottish music scene with her co-run collective Milk, which has put on some of Glasgow's best music nights. She's an award-winning documentary filmmaker, having released two extremely important and thought-provoking shorts. It's her work with MHF Live and Mental Health Foundation that's seen her pull from all aspects of her work in music and film, and her passion for helping those struggling is clear. It seems there's nothing that Hannah can't turn her hand to, but it's her tour de force attitude that places her as one of Scotland's most notable creative talents. So, welcome to Podcart. My special guest today is Hannah Curry. For people that don't know you, Hannah, explain who you are and what it is that you do.
I'm a filmmaker and I am also a club promoter, so I do both of those things kind of in tandem. Basically a jack of all trades, really.
You've had it's been quite an interesting few years that you've had that we'll come on to a bit later, but you've picked songs, as usual, with this Life is Like a Box of Records that have soundtracked your life so far. I want to kick off with the first one, which has been quite topical of late, thanks to a band called Puddle of Mud. And it's Nirvana's About a Girl. So why this song?
Okay, well, before Puddle of Mud butchered this song, this is one of my favourite Nirvana songs. Nirvana very much reminds me of my mum. It's her favourite band. And she used to blast it in the car when she was taking us to school. I remember getting into trouble at school because I was singing the lyrics to Rape Me once, not knowing what it meant. And my mum had played that, so she got hauled in. But About a Girl, I kind of rediscovered my love for it after I watched the Montage of Heck documentary about Kurt Cobain, amazing doc, and realised from that documentary that it's about basically Kurt taking advantage of his ex-girlfriend, so the girl that kind of pre-existed Courtney Love, and had to kind of watch that whole thing play out on a national stage, and she was kind of the original girlfriend who just loved him so much, but he was this musician who wanted to kind of go do his thing. And it's about him kind of taking advantage of her, having her there as a sounding board and a pal, but not wanting to commit to her, which I think is quite relatable, but also just so kind of just such a perfect rendition of what happens when somebody kind of has a creative, calling that they have to they have to fulfill, and when other people around them maybe don't get that. I still think it's obviously tragic what happened to Kurt Cobain, that fame kind of found him before he was ready for it, and he was sort of far too fragile a person to really deal with a lot of the stuff that came with it. But yeah, I mean, first and foremost, it was a song my mum played to us in the car to school, and I always kind of knew that my parents were cool from their music tastes, because I would always kind of bring in these songs for friends to listen to, and people would be really into it. It was a toss-up between Nirvana and the Eels, which was another one that they kind of played really often, and that continued all the way through. I mean, it's still happening. My mum and dad are kind of the source of a lot of my music tastes nowadays. They just mine music and find the gold and then give it to me, so I don't have to do all the research, which is nice.
What's your first musical memory?
Run Dusty Run by the Long Riders. I remember my dad playing me that and me absolutely loving it and dancing around to it. I don't know what age I was, but the song was released in 1984, well before I was born, so I guess I was very young, maybe 4 or 5, dancing around to that. And then I distinctly remember my dad's 40th birthday, so he's 60 now, almost 61, so 20 years ago, like I would have been 10, and I remember requesting this song and him putting it on and loving the fact that all his friends really liked the song and I liked it, and I was like, oh, like I know this song, and it's so impressive that I know this song and they all love it too, kind of thing, like just like that, having that feeling of like mutually loving music. And kind of dancing together and being a part of it. That would be my earliest. I know it's a bit of a obscure reference. I also remember my dad teaching me the drums on upturned buckets and basins to Massive Attack's Teardrop, which, you know, anyone who knows that song knows the drum beat in it is pretty straightforward. Literally boom boom ptch, boom boom ptch. But I just like, oh my god, I spent days, hours like learning this beat on a wee makeshift drum kit, and I did go on to learn the drums, but I sadly gave it up. I'd love to pick it up again.
When did you first realise that you wanted to have kind of some working association with music and the creative industries?
Much like anything that I kind of try and dig my claws into, or whatever you, my little troll hands, I just greatly enjoy something or greatly admire something and then think like, I want to do that, and I'm actually a very self-conscious person. I struggle with self-belief, so usually it's like, I want to do that and oh, I can't do it. So for all of these years of going to gigs and I kind of went into music journalism because I just so wanted to go to more gigs, and obviously that was a way of getting into them for free. I wanted to be in about it, I wanted to meet the people who made music, but always kind of, it took me a long time, always it took me a lot of kind of like, oh, I'd love to do that, before I would kind of be like, oh well, I can find a way in. So I can't play a musical instrument, I can't sing to save myself, I don't have the confidence to be on stage, but I could, you know, write, so I can write about bands. And then from that, obviously starting up Milk with Aileen, we were both doing music journalism at the time, both absolutely loving gigs, and it was, yeah, it was that kind of thing of like, oh, how do we put on a gig? And we were lucky to be given an opportunity at the time by somebody that we'd kind of crossed paths with via our music journalism to start up our own night, and we just obviously took that and ran with it. But it's always been, I really want to do that, but I don't know how, and then kind of working out a way in through the back door to be more involved in something than maybe I should be, but because, you know, I don't have any musical talent, that's a source of great regret, but I wanted to be involved in that world, so it was kind of like, how can I adapt what I do have to be a part of that?
Tell us about your next pick, Benny King, Stand By Me, and at what point that came into your life, and it's such a popular song for a lot of people, so why did it shine?
Yeah, for me this is quite a sad one, but it's a song that was played at my grandfather's funeral. It was the first time that I'd ever lost somebody, and it hit me really hard when he died. The first sort of touch of grief that you experience is always going to be the worst, I guess. I hope it's the worst. I just couldn't comprehend at the time that that would happen to me again, that I would feel that way again, because it was so painful. And I didn't even see my grandpa, you know, maybe once every fortnight. It wasn't like maybe once every month. I don't really remember. I just remember the overwhelming feeling of guilt that I hadn't seen him enough when I lost him, and that was going to be it, that person wasn't going to be tangibly there anymore. And the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So darling, he had a humanist funeral, so you choose all of the songs, and the humanist sort of tells stories about the person, and it was really, really lovely. It was a really warm experience, and I always remember, like, really distinct. I remember so much distinctly from that time. It's kind of imprinted on my memory, but I remember the humanist, whatever you call them, I don't know, head humanist or whatever they are, coming over to our house and or my gran's house and writing everything down, and we said that we wanted Benny King, and she wrote Benny King, like B-E-N-N-Y, when obviously it's Ben E standing for Arrow King, and me like looking at it and being like, oh, like, she doesn't know who Benny King is. But anyway, like, it's a lovely song. Every time it comes on now, obviously it's a huge song, so it comes on in places like cinemas or restaurants or shops, and it just, like, every time it comes on, it totally gets me. It's just like strikes right deep into my core, and I think of him. It's beautiful. I love it.
You and your brother are kind of quite close, I think it's fair to say. Were there any musicians that he introduced you to, or vice versa, when you were growing up?
Yeah, my brother very much introduced me to the world of hip-hop. He still absolutely lives and breathes hip-hop. So when we came to work on my first film together, which was about a rapper from Glasgow, Tim just, like, took that and ran with it. And if only we could have, because of rights, obviously you can't use... we couldn't kind of use, if we wanted to take it around film festivals, we couldn't use a lot of big hip hop names, but they would have had some soundtrack if we'd had the money to do that. But obviously, as it stood, we used a lot of the rappers, the rapper Lumo, who the film's about. We used a lot of his music, which was amazing, and music from various other people in the kind of classical hip hop scene. But yeah, Tim, introduced me to Biggie. He was right into Eminem, obviously, Dr. Dre. He, in later life, Kendrick Lamar, and Aesop Rock, like, just people, there are lots of obscure names as well, Mac Miller back in the day, who's now not so obscure, obviously, but very much introduced me to all of that stuff. I can't say I introduced him to anything that he would want to listen to. Although, actually, now that we are older, and I lived with my brother for a really substantial amount of time when I moved back from London last year, we kind of have started to fuse in our music taste. So we listen to a lot of, like, we love watching Colour Show on YouTube, which is just all these kind of amazing artists, a lot of soul and a lot of hip-hop in there too, R&B. We like just chilling out and watching that. We love The Blaze. I think we've kind of got to a place where we have unified in our tastes, but Tim absolutely can't stand all of my kind of throwback stuff. That basically everything I DJ at my nights is just like like wild horses wouldn't drag him along to my nights.
Madonna, I remember when The Ray of Light, this song came out, but also the album, and it was a bit of a game changer for me, certainly. I thought that it was the best thing. I still think it might be the best album that she's ever produced.
Yeah.
Why Ray of Light, and how much have you kind of stuck with her since this album?
I couldn't agree more that it's a game changer of a song. It's just, it fills me with joy when it comes on. Truthfully, I haven't stuck with Madonna massively, like in terms of followed all of her new stuff, although it always kind of gets round to me eventually. I'm not like one of these people that, you know, would pay whatever through the nose for a ticket to go and see her. I just don't really believe in yeah, I mean, I just don't have the money, basically. But I love, like, she's obviously like a total legend, and she's done so much amazing stuff that it's hard to comprehend. And I think she's one of those few living artists that can truly be appreciated in real time. You know, so many people, like, you kind of rediscover their back catalogue after they're gone, and then there's people like Madonna. You know, Michael Jackson was one of them before it was kind of a bit of a grey area, that. I mean, Ray of Light, this song, it's the title track from the album, same album that Frozen came off of, and I just remember this being a period, like a moment in time in my life where music was just like buzzing, alive, probably just the first time that I'd really come to music and watched Top of the Pops and watched all the music videos and just been like completely like eyes opened to what was out there. I mean, I had to check this, but it was 1998 that it was released, and that for me has very much defined like a time in my life that is so nostalgic and warm. And it's almost like it's before, you know, you go to high school and become a teenager and everything goes to shit. It's like just pure unadulterated joy of like dancing around your living room to music. And this song was put on at a party that I was at like maybe 3 years ago, and it was like I was just the right level of steaming to be like, oh my god, I forgot about this song, and it just like reawakened it for me, and now I play it all the time at our 90s night. So yeah, that kind of love for the 90s, early 2000s never left me, and I'd say a song like Ray of Light is just so smack bang in the middle of that era.
I want to talk about a bit about Aileen Lynn, who is your friend and also you set up Milk with, and it's how I got to know both of you, and we've done some fantastic things together, but you've also become a bit of a kind of a collective to aim towards. You're so driven and passionate, and you're so on the money when it comes to the promotion of your events and so on. When you first met Aileen, what was that? Did you immediately feel that you'd met almost like a kindred spirit? How are things now and planning around what you want to do?
Aileen is a very special person, and I knew that from the moment that I set eyes on her, which sounds kind of creepy, but I met Aileen through working in Radio Bar in Ashton Lane, and I saw her and I was just like, who is that? She's just radiated like happiness and a glow. She's such a positive person. I mean, we're complete yin and yang, because I'm like the total like pessimist to the point that it makes me super super organized, and that's kind of a skill, but Aileen is she's the complete optimist, and she's really taught me a lot about just chilling out and enjoying things and stopping overthinking everything. She's just good inside and out. She's golden. So when we first met, it was like I knew I wanted to be her pal. We started hanging out after, you know, if you work in bars, you usually kind of have drinks after parties at people's houses and stuff. And then, yeah, just became really close. I think the time we sort of realised that we had a lot in common was I had 2 tickets to Stag and Dagger through a journalism thing. I can't remember who I was writing for. And whoever I was going with, I think it was my brother. I said that I was taking my brother. And then it was my brother, because then he was sick. He was so hungover, he was sick, and then he'd like hoovered up his own sick, which is disgusting, but that's stuck in my mind. And I remember phoning Aileen and being like, oh, Tim can't go, this has happened, and I was laughing about it. And she, on the spot, quit her job at Pizza Hut to come to Stag and Dagger with me because she wanted to go so much. And we ended up just getting like absolutely blasted and not writing a thing for the whatever paper I was meant to be writing for, which obviously is not something I'd advocate, but it was a very like great day. And in terms of now, I mean, yeah, it's tricky because I suppose we sort of entering, Milk has been running for almost a decade, and I definitely, I don't know, like, I just can't really imagine life without it in some shape or size. But I think that, you know, we started this in our early 20s and now we're in our early 30s, and obviously like life changes and tastes change, and you know, the amount of time that we had to invest in what was originally a fortnightly night with 3 bands and DJs, like I can't believe I ever had time to book, you know, 3 bands and DJs for every 2 weeks and still manage to kind of get the crowds in. So now obviously it's a kind of a lighter approach. We're not putting on live music. We're kind of putting on themed nights, DJ nights, and things that are a lot more nostalgic and kind of looking back to that youth. But I mean, the most amazing thing is that we still have this kind of like army of like Milk people that came at the beginning, that we still see at our nights now, that that are just like very much into the same vibe as us, and as long as that's there, we'll do it. We've got a night, a pop punk karaoke night at Block that's on hold right now, and as soon as we're allowed to return to normal, we will. But obviously, you know, it's kind of the last thing on people's, well, it's not. I mean, everyone wants to go out and have fun, but at the end of the day, like, yeah, we have to prioritise people being safe. So we're just going to wait and see, and then we'll adapt as we always do to whatever things look like after all of this is over.
And speaking of pop punk, well, the kind of post-hardcore as well, it's Funeral for a Friend, and that's your next pick. How significant were this band for you when you were growing up?
Oh, like so huge. Funeral for a Friend. It's kind of like I moved from the 90s and being defined by pop to like the sort of mid-2000s being defined by, not mid-2000s, early 2000s, being defined by pop punk and emo and everything that came along with it. I just entered high school and in total cliche fashion, like became a complete emo, moody, kind of I don't need friends kind of person, and this was the music that spoke to me. And yeah, I remember blasting this music kind of throughout high school and having so many good times as well, like Cat House Unders. And when we were kind of, yeah, trying to sneak into clubs kind of early on as well. So All the gigs, like the gigs at Barrowlands with Cider and Blackcurrant, the many lost memories, the photographs on like disposable cameras that you would go and get developed, and it would just be like total chaos. And just thinking you were really cool and looking back and being like, oh my God, what was I wearing? But like, yeah, I love it. I still love it. It's for me, again, it's a moment in time that's, you know, massively sort of shaped my life and given me many, many good times. So I unashamedly love that song.
Are there any other musical moments, such as grunge or hip hop or dance or whatever, that you maybe wish you'd have been part of within that, like either decade or period of years, that, and you're almost jealous that you missed them?
To be honest, I guess like part of me is sort of sad that I wasn't into like techno and dance and stuff like that when it was kind of in its heyday. Like, for instance, everybody was going to the Arches when I was kind of in my late teens, early 20s, and I would go occasionally to nights, but I at that stage was not indulging in the sort of things that make that kind of music really fun. So I feel like I did miss out on a sort of collective like awakening with regards to certain kinds of music, and I think that would have been an awesome thing to have been part of together. I get jealous of so many eras when I watch documentaries about them and stuff, and then I'm like, oh, that must have been such an amazing thing to have been a part of, like when, you know, the Beatles first like revolutionised live music, and it was just like chaos and everything that came after it, like all of the stuff that my mum and dad went to see in the 70s and the 80s. My mum and dad were going to see the Undertones, the Clash, all those kind of bands, and like that by all accounts sounds like it was an amazing thing to be a part of, and I think we kind of can't appreciate just how meaningful those tracks are to our parents, because like imagine that kind of that coming out, and now you have so many replicas, but at the time that was just like brand new, and it would have been incredible to have been a part of if music had kind of been sleepy and samey for that long, and then like bang, like comes all that music. So yeah, I definitely get sort of hazy-eyed for certain periods in time and think like that would have been amazing to have been a part of, but I have no regrets that my sort of period was 90s, early 2000s. I think it's very much like a laughing stock to a lot of people, and you know, like my dad just like is horrified by it because he's such a muso and brought me up with this amazing music education, and he's just like, what the fuck, Hannah? But it's like it's something that I grew up through, and it's just fun, and yeah, like I don't feel bad about that at all. I think grime though is very, very, I would love to like know what it feels like to be in that grime scene, because I mean, and which is just not going to happen as a white woman, but I think that the camaraderie and the like just some of the sheer talent of people in that scene and kind of the way that they all bounce off each other would be pretty awesome as well to actually be right in amongst.
Before we come on to your film pick, I want to talk about your film making, which has really kind of brought you into your own, but it's also created some incredible talking points and, you know, I mean, award-winning opportunities for you. So first of all, I want to talk about We Are All Here, which is about Lumo. And how you got approached to do that, or decided to make that film, but also what you have kind of since learnt from it and what it's led to.
Yeah, I've always wanted to make documentaries. And like I was saying earlier with the music thing, it was always that thing of watching other people do it, admiring work and thinking, I could never do that, I wish I could. And as I got older, kind of flipping that on its head and being like, well, you know, why do I think I can't? What do these people that make films have that I don't have? And a lot of the time it's, you know, they have an insight into the industry from an early age. They're lucky enough to know filmmakers and kind of find a way through. Or they just have more general awareness or confidence of what the possibilities are in their life. But when I left school, I just didn't even know that filmmaking was a job. And I did history at uni. It was like, oh, right, choose a subject that you're kind of interested in. And sat for 4 years doing an academic subject that really I had absolutely no intention or interest of being a history teacher or an academic. So it's puzzling, like, why I wouldn't have gone to do film at uni. I literally didn't know that it was an option, which I think speaks a lot for kind of our education system and the way that it's very much built towards academia. And not so much towards practical jobs or creative jobs. I think in some high schools that's definitely changing, but certainly it wasn't an option for me as far as I was concerned. So it took me the long road round. My brother was always really interested in film and TV and loved movies, so he kind of went into that world before I did and was an editor, so that was kind of my window in. And then I was a journalist for a while, and I did use a lot of those history skills, interviewing people and things like that, because I was an oral historian, so it's all about interviewing people about their lives. So I used a lot of that in my journalism, and then eventually made my way into TV via commercials, advertising, and then finally in my late 20s decided to give documentary making a try, and spent all of the money that I'd made in freelance commercials going to do a 6-week course in New York, which was like, yeah, admittedly half Rami in New York because I'm obsessed with the city, and half learning how to make films. But the film making part of it was really intense. It was long days, it was every day including the weekend for 6 weeks, and I made my first film about a drag queen, and from that I just got a total love for it, got completely hooked. So a year later, I decided to go and do a full year's master's in filmmaking at Goldsmiths in London. And it was there that I read about Lumo's story while I was kind of first learning to make films properly. I learned about Lumo's story and I reached out to his friends and asked if they would be up for me making that story, because I had access to all the kit from being at uni, and I had for the first time kind of the confidence that I could take this story and make something good with it, make something powerful that could make a difference, and all of that kind of, yeah, it was sort of the perfect storm at the time in terms of filmmaking for me to be well positioned to make a film, and to give that the time and care that it needed. I'm really proud of what we made together.
I mean, moving on to something also as poignant, which was your film That Joke Isn't Funny Anymore, about your uncle, which was produced, directed by yourself and produced by Beth Allen from Forest of Black. You've won it, you're a BAFTA winner now, which is, I think, for anyone that kind of knows how hard you work and the self-doubt that you have, then it was a real, it was incredibly emotional for a lot of people. When you were making, what's the difference between making a film about someone that's a family member and I mean, how do you try and kind of separate yourself being a director as opposed to that person being your relative?
It's really difficult, and a lot more difficult than I sort of expected. I think coming off the back of the first film, I always wanted to make this film about my aunt and uncle, and I'd actually given it a go at uni, but maybe just didn't quite have the knowledge yet to make something good from it. So it'd been a kind of midterm project that I tried to, but from shooting for that midterm project, I had loads and loads of footage with my aunt and uncle, and I used a lot of that in the new film. So it was a really good thing to do. I still struggle with that one, because what I really didn't want it to be was about me and about the film, because I think I've seen some filmmakers make films about their family and sensitive subjects within their family, and they're amazing, incredible films, but there's almost like a layer of disingenuity running through it, where you can kind of see that the films come first, if you know what I mean. And I was so hyper aware of not taking this real painful thing that's happening in my family's life and making something out of it that didn't do that justice. And I really wrangled with that in the edit. Like I really struggled, and by the end, by the time I'd actually made it, I wasn't completely convinced that I'd managed to do what I'd set out to do. But obviously the film's been received remarkably well, and when I speak to people after screenings, they seem to be getting the things from it that I hoped they would, and they absolutely, you know, the film is really about my aunt and about her her sort of endurance and resilience with a very, very difficult situation, because things aren't really necessarily going to change for my uncle because of his brain injury, whereas my aunt's on a journey and sort of finding her way through being able to cope with that long term. So and they like the film, so that's all that really matters to me. But it was a tough process. I was very obsessed with the fact that was I doing them justice or not, and that kind of led me to get quite just in a bad place with it. So that's something I think as a filmmaker you kind of have to work on constantly. You have to realise that when you're going in and telling stories that are very personal to people, you have to constantly be considering the effect on those people, but also the effect on yourself, and kind of taking stock and being able to take a step back and speak to other people about it. That taught me a very important lesson that, like, you know, you can't neglect your own mental health when you're making films about other people. So yeah, I'd like to think that I have the kind of mechanisms in place now to be able to handle that going forward.
Staying on the subject of film, your next pick is from Film Soundtrack, which we ask people to do, and it's from Garden State Soundtrack, which is arguably one of the greatest film soundtracks out there. The band Coldplay, who unfortunately kind of get quite a lot of stick every now and again, but this song, Don't Panic, why did you pick this in particular from this soundtrack?
It was a toss-up between this and Shins, because the Shins are obviously featured quite heavily on that soundtrack and they're brilliant as well. But I've chosen Coldplay because, exactly for the reason that you mentioned, they've become this sort of behemoth now, and it's kind of not a band I would now associate myself with, not because I don't think that they're hugely talented, but I just, it's kind of gotten too much of a machine for me, and I kind of tend to check out at that stage when things get like really, really overproduced, and it just takes away, I suppose, what I love about music, which is, you know, people writing songs in their bedroom and then releasing them to the world, and you can just feel everything that they've put into that song. Whereas, you know, once they've had that level, once they become people who are kind of quite far removed from our lives in terms of the way that they live their lives, I think it's very hard to get that relatability factor in there. But this is like the first studio album from Coldplay. It was pretty stunning, and you can't deny his talent.
Homes, places we've grown, all of us are done for.
Yeah, Garden State is one of my favourite films. It's definitely not for everyone, but it's obviously written by Zach Braff. I think he wrote it, directed it. Features Natalie Portman, and I saw that as well when I was a teenager, and I was just completely like bowled over by the sort of indie film. It's just the perfect indie film. It's just, it's funny. It's got love. It's got heartache. It's really, really beautifully done. And this song, Don't Panic, is kind of a standout track for me from it. I mean, I love that song. It's such a nice song.
One of the greatest bands of all time, Talking Heads, and it's great to see them on a playlist. This Must Be the Place, which is generally not a lot of people are a bit more stereotypical in their song choice. So why this song?
This song just defines my life in London. I lived there for a couple of years. I obviously went to study there. I moved into this house with four other people in Southeast London, and I just landed on my feet with it. Like, I didn't know any people in that area of London at all. London's obviously massive, so the people I did know were like 2 hours away. And I found this house on spare room and moved in with four people that I'd never met before. I'd met them on Skype to see the room. So kind of a massive gamble, which could have gone either way. And I could have ended up, you know, really miserable during my time in London. But as it happened, I landed in this group of people that had about 40 friends who were all so sound. That lot were definitely a lot more into their kind of electronic and techno and all that kind of thing. But we went to like loads of gigs and festivals and clubs together and just had the best time. And I mean, London summers are long, the days are really long and hotter than they are in Scotland. So we would just hang out all day and then kind of party all night. And this song would always get played at 2, 3, 4 in the morning. A sort of shared love of this song with my housemate Max, who I was really close with, and yeah, just it just makes me smile because it reminds me of that time. You know, those songs that when they come on, you just think, like, I know for the rest of my life I will associate that song with that time, and that makes me really happy because it was a wonderful time. I really do miss London, and I miss them.
Moving the focus to kind of now, and obviously we're within a pandemic, we're in a lockdown, and it's affected the creative industries in a way that I guess that was I suppose in ways unprecedented, but still you know, just as devastating emotionally and economically. How has it been for you, and how have you had to kind of try and adapt and look to surviving?
It's really tough, and I think it's getting tougher the longer that it goes on, and you kind of realise that your sort of earlier comforts to yourself of like, oh, but when it's, we'll do this and when it's over. And now you're kind of looking at the long haul potentially and thinking, I have no idea what the world's going to look like on the other side of this and where my place is on the other side of this. But, you know, I did spend like a fair few days, maybe even weeks, kind of mourning that and getting really down in the dumps about it. And then I sort of picked myself up and thought, well, you know, my job has been to tell people's stories. Like, those stories still need to be told, probably now more than ever. Yeah, there might not be money for the creative industries, or certainly the pockets of money that there are maybe aren't going to be prioritised for, you know, newbies like me. But where there's a will, there's a way. And I know enough amazing people who are invested in, you know, telling stories and in continuing to put the sort of important subjects like front and centre and in people's line of vision. So I feel that I'm pretty confident that I have enough drive and enough people around me with that drive to tell these stories one way or another. And I kind of accepted, like, when I went from commercial production into documentary filmmaking, it was a massive adjustment that I had to make to in terms of like well, money coming in and money not always coming in. So I've kind of been living like that for a wee while, like sometimes okay with it, sometimes not so much, but it's something that I'm willing to like get to grips with, basically, is just doing, living life at a bit more of a living within my means, really, and realizing that I am very, very lucky to have a roof over my head, supportive family, emotional support when I need it, and that a lot of people don't have that. So it's kind of for me, I just think my priority, as much as getting myself back on my feet, will be to try and get other people back on theirs, because some people are going to be hit really, really hard by this.
And I, you know, obviously this is all connected with mental health, and you and I have bonded and worked on things with mental health, and we have stuff coming up as well. But you have kind of gone on to lend your skills and experience and lived experience by working with Mental Health Foundation. How has that kind of been for you, and how's it opened up your way of thinking surrounding the subject of mental health?
Well, Mental Health Foundation are really important, I think, as a charity, in terms of getting mental health on the agenda in government, and really trying to fight the stigma that still exists. And they're an amazing organisation to work for and to collaborate with. So I've volunteered for them when I was a teenager at their Scottish Mental Health Arts Festival, which is still running to this day. And I got back in tow with them when I sent them the Lumo film, and they selected it. They selected it for an award at their film festival, and then they got in touch with me and said, actually, what are you doing right now, Hannah? Because we've got a position to sort of project manage a new fundraising initiative called MHF Live. So I did that with them for quite a long time. Was it almost a year? And now, yeah, I'm trying to collaborate with them going forward into this period to sort of bring my creative skills together with their knowledge and their networks and their reach, to see if we can try and create something that basically helps us to process what's happening right now to all of us and to heal. So I really want you to be involved in that as well, Helena, as you know. So I'm really hoping that it's kind of what I was talking about before with regards to sort of adapting to the way things are now and reaching out to each other and realizing that, like, you know, you have friends that have skills, and as much as making money is really necessary, important for us to live, you know, in this new world that we're emerging into, having purpose is also really important. And if you have friends and contacts that you know are really great at one thing or another, and that they could potentially feed into a project that is overall going to have a positive influence, then I think give people the opportunity to be part of that, because it's really, really nice to be able to sort of put your heads together and do something positive just because it's positive. I think Mental Health Foundation have informed my way of thinking a lot, in that I just so believe that now more than ever it's essential to have somebody standing up for mental health and shouting out about mental health, because it just gets buried underneath everything else. The economy, the capitalism, constant striving to reach potential and then getting there absolutely broken and gasping, and not being able to enjoy like the benefits of what you've worked so hard for. It just is a model that doesn't work for me. And I know that because I got broken myself and I reached total burnout, and I just have massively, you know, that lived experience for me has massively changed my perspective, because I couldn't go on the way that I was going, just constant striving, constant kind of battling to work hard at all costs kind of thing. Like, now I'm much better at knowing the importance of slowing down a wee bit and taking a breather and respecting that other people need to do that too. You know, you can't expect other people to have things to you like right now. Even if you're ready for it to go right now, it's kind of like other people have got their own shit going on. So I'm a lot more mindful of that now, and I think everybody could really massively benefit from being more mindful of that, that, you know, just because things are going okay for you doesn't mean they're going okay for everyone. And it's about trying to sort of adapt. And Mental Health Foundation, really, right when I was organising a massive gig for them in London, I was struggling with my mental health, and the support that they gave me to sort of find my feet again really was what led to me being able to go on and do that gig, for it to sell out the Amira in London and be a massive sort of like source of promotion for Mental Health Foundation and source of income for them. And that was purely because they adapted to give me a bit of space. So I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, the current model that most of us are working under being broken, and having to look at other ways that we can, because I don't want the world to just go back to just like strive. Like, let's, you know, it's just, it's pointless. Like, you need to enjoy life.
So Withered Hand, a Scottish artist and such a talent, and this song, I mean, this is your one and only Scottish artist on this playlist. So why did you pick this song and this artist in particular?
I just absolutely love Withered Hand. My dad introduced me to Withered Hand, and was one of those, you know, like total wow moments. Like, everyone talks about that time their dad puts on a record for them and you're just completely captivated by it. And that Withered Hand was that for me. And yeah, he's Scottish, which is awesome. I No Cigarettes is the last track on my film That Joke Isn't Funny Anymore, and I had it in mind right from the beginning, really. And I kind of used it as a placeholder in my edit as this last final track, thinking all the time, like, fuck, I'm gonna have to find a track for this, like, but nothing's as good as this track. And then Beth, you know, in Forest of Black had done some stuff with Withered Hand before, so reached out to him and said, look, we don't have any money for this film really, but like, would you be up for letting us use this track? And he said, can I see the film? And he watched it and got back and he loved the film and said that we could use the track. I went and got lost, always the back end of this pantomime horse. All we seem to do these days is wave our arms and yell, other people are hell. And what's that song you're singing? Everybody heard. When everybody lies, don't wanna remember too many regrets. And no cigarettes, cause I'm not a smoker, but I said I was. And the elevator stuck between the floors, it's getting to me. Don't let forsake you. Rack them up and knock them down again. You're changing direction. I won't know where I was. The back end of the pantomime horse is getting to me. Oh, hey. Maestro, a drum roll, please. This is the golden age. I mean, that to me is like as good as Madonna saying I can use her track at the end of the film, honestly. It's so perfect for my film, because it's about sort of frustrated love and relationships I just couldn't have picked a better song. Beth loves it too. It's one of her favourite tracks. So we were both like super, super keen. And I mean, the whole thing with my dad introducing me to Withered Hand, like quite often when I say to people, oh, like my dad introduced me to your stuff, or like even if it's, you know, it's famous people I've met or not so, or local artists or whatever, people are like, oh great, so I'm your dad's type of music. And it's like, no, like being my dad's type of music is like a huge compliment, because he's such a musical, he lives and breathes music. If you're in his radar, then you're doing pretty well. So yeah, it's just, I think it's beautiful.
Awesome. Well, my goodness, we're already at the end, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. And for anyone that kind of wants to follow what you're doing, what's the best way for them to do that?
I'm on Instagram and Twitter. I've familiarised myself with Twitter because I found it's actually a really good place to follow filmmakers and kind of get lots of chat about what's happening in the world of film. So I'm on Twitter as just Hannah Curry, my name, HannahCurrie, and I'm on Instagram as Hannah Milk, which is obviously my name, then the name of my comics. And thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.